Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Reports of more investigations into whether troops killed or abused innocent civilians in Iraq. We've been hearing about Haditha, new reports now about a separate case in Iraq, an April 26 incident in Hammamdia, in which seven Marines and one Navy corpsman are expected to face criminal charges, including murder and kidnapping. The men are accused of killing an Iraqi man, then trying to cover it up by planting an AK-47 near his body, so it would appear he was an insurgent. In another incident, the BBC has now aired video of an attack in March in the village of Ishaqi, about 50 miles north of Baghdad. The U.S. military has said that four people died in that attack, targeting a suspected insurgent, but the video shows that at least five children were killed, and local Iraqis say 11 were killed. This comes as the Los Angeles Times reports that a military investigation has concluded that Marines killed 24 citizens without provocation last November in Haditha. Well, joining us now with more on these cases is Tony Perry of the Los Angeles Times. And, Tony, there are now so many different cases surfacing. We want to start with the new reports, at least to many today, of the Marines and the Navy corpsmen being held in the brig at Camp Pendleton. This is the case in Hammamdia. Tell us, what are the allegations in that incident?
Well, the allegations, and they're still not yet formally charged, the allegations are that they broke into an Iraqi home, drug a man out, killed him, and then tried to make it look like they had caught an armed insurgent under cover of nightfall, digging a hole so that he could plant a roadside bomb to blow up a Humvee the next day. They've not yet been formally charged, but that's how the investigation is leaning. And we're talking here about Marines who are experienced combat troops, some in their second and third deployments. This is the 3rd Battalion, 5th Regiment, a very experienced, good group of Marines. This happened April 26th. Unlike the Haditha incident, which took Time magazine to kind of blow the cover off of it, in this, the military moved much more quickly, snatched up the Marines and the corpsmen, sent them back to Camp Pendleton. They're now on the brig. Others are on restricted duty at the post to keep them from leaving. They might be witnesses or other people who could face charges. Mm-hmm. They moved much more quickly in this incident.
Well, and then there's another incident that's surfacing, and there is a video, allegedly, of the killings in the village of Ishaqi. Here's an AP interview with a man from that town. Let's listen to that first.
Children were stuck in the room, alone and surrounded. After they handcuffed them, they shot them dead. Later, they struck the house with their planes. They wanted to hide the evidence. Even a six-month-old infant was killed.
Tony Perry, we understand that there are also reports, though, that there is an admission that there was an al-Qaeda operative in that house. What has the military said?
Well, the military hasn't said a lot. This is more like the Haditha incident, where they had one story and now they're backing off of it. This one is going to be much more complex to sort out, because remember, this is an enemy that likes to hide among women and children. And so what may look like an innocent house may be hiding either arms catches or insurgents themselves. This one is going to be much more difficult to sort out than the Hammamdia incident, which seems pretty straightforward from what we can tell.
Well, U.S. commanders in response to Hammamdia have responded to the allegations by ordering new ethics training for all troops in Iraq. But the Iraqi government, many Iraqi leaders, are demanding that the U.S. hand over files on the investigations. The Iraqi government wants to conduct its own investigation. How do you see that playing out?
Very, very difficult situation, very complex. Wherever the U.S. military goes, they usually sign a what they call status of forces agreement with the host government, in this case the new fledgling Iraqi government. I don't know that they have an agreement like that yet. I think it's going to be a test of that new fledgling government in terms of its credibility with its people. It's going to be a test for the U.S. military and how they treat that government. That adds a layer of complexity and stickiness to this whole situation.
That's Tony Perry. He's with the Los Angeles Times. Tony, thanks so much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Well, now, to the world of mountaineering, where there is an angry buzz after reports that at least 40 climbers on their way up Mount Everest last month walked past dying British climber David Sharp. They also walked past him on the way down. And today, several climbing websites are reporting that Sharp was lucid enough to state his name, and he was videotaped by a team recording an expedition for the Discovery Channel and by cameras on Sherpa's helmets, images that were sent live to team leaders at base camp. So, could David Sharp have been saved? Should he have been saved? Or would that have endangered other lives? Sharp died in what's called the death zone, just below the summit, air so thin that walking is difficult. Last month, a record 14 people died there, the second highest death toll on Everest. And days after David Sharp died, another man was similarly passed by. Somehow, he survived a night alone on the mountain before climbers came to his aid, and he was rescued. So, some climbers are asking, why wasn't David Sharp? New Zealander Mark Ingalls was one of the climbers who walked past David Sharp. He is also, by the way, a double amputee, the result of frostbite from a trek a quarter century ago. We reached him in a hospital in New Zealand, where he's expected to lose several fingers and more of his legs as a result of the climb, the one in which he bypassed David Sharp. This is one of the few interviews that Mark's given since returning from Everest. He ignited a firestorm when he first talked about the man he left behind. Listen closely. We started by asking him, what are people saying to him?
Someone asked me very recently, you know, if I was in David's position, would I, you know, want me to stop? And I guess my first response was, yes, I would want someone to stop, but I wouldn't want me. I mean, I was the only double amputee on the mountain. Behind me, there were far more competent people, members of my team, members of other teams, that could help. And he received some assistance. Now, part of the unfortunate thing about the David situation and the reporting of it is that they seem to have focused on myself, which is very unfortunate because I was at the front of the group, so I wasn't there when much of the assistance was given. So,
explain why it might be hard for someone to give assistance. I mean, we have heard climbers say that there's an unspoken thought on the part of some climbers that you really are in no position to help someone else if you might endanger your life. Tell us more about that.
A combination of two things. You are in the death zone. It is extremely difficult just to survive there. You know, there's no insurance policy up there if something goes wrong. For me, I didn't want to be above 8,500 meters without at least two people near me who could help, what I would call an insurance policy. There's a lot of people on the mountain that don't have that insurance policy, unfortunately.
Right. There's something called bystander effect on the mountain, which is sometimes in large groups. Everyone thinks someone else is going to do it. Did you think someone else was going to do it?
No, we have very good radio communications. One of the saddest things, my biggest disappointment, is that people would assume that of me.
Well, in fact, we should point out you're a New Zealander. You've been criticized by another New Zealander, none other than the first man to climb Everest in 1953, Sir Edmund Hillary. He directly said that you and other climbers should have stopped your ascent and helped. He said that human life is far more important than getting to the top of a mountain.
I think if you do your research, you'll find out that Sir Edmund Hillary has indicated that he has been misquoted. The circumstances of that day, there's been never any information released about it, partly because several of us have an understanding with David's family. David was in a very, very poor condition. I can't describe it exactly because I made a commitment to his family. And what it does is it does affect you. I mean, as do all the bodies that you see. It's an extreme environment that you need to focus and fight hard just to survive yourself. Mm. I survived not for myself but for my family. Climbing Everest, getting to the top is only halfway. You know, I had no obsession about getting to the top of Everest, but I did have an obsession about coming home alive.
There's other, you know, broader talk about Everest going on right now. I know you're familiar with it, that it's too crowded and that too many people are going up in groups. An Australian climber and author, Ken Vernon, talking about the record number of deaths, raised questions about the issue of inexperienced and or disabled climbers paying to be short-roped to the top. You, as we mentioned, a double amputee. You climb with two metal legs, we understand. What about those comments that perhaps people who are disabled or who are traveling in groups and paying extraordinary amounts of money and aren't as skilled, even as you are, perhaps, shouldn't be on the mountain?
Well, you've got it around completely the wrong way. The bodies that litter the mountain almost invariably have come from the large numbers of people who have paid small amounts of money or the very inexperienced.
And Mark, we want to let you go. We, as we said, you're in the hospital recuperating, and we very much appreciate your time. But you're about to lose more of your body to this sport. Is it worth it to you? Have you changed your mind at all about it?
Worth it, absolutely. I've got other interests in my life that I want to focus on. A lot of them focus around my family, who have supported me fantastically in the past.
That's Mark Ingles, who summited Mount Everest last month, indicating that he may not be climbing the mountain again. He has other mountains to climb, including staying home with his family. Mark is a double amputee from New Zealand. He's been criticized for being one of the many climbers who walked past a man struggling to stay alive on the mountain. Joining us now in the studio is David Roberts, author of On the Ridge Between Life and Death, a book in which he reflects back on his climbing days with some regret. David, we want to spend a few minutes talking to you about this controversy, about what's happened at Mount Everest. In the time we have before the break, and we'll talk to you more afterwards, what do you think about what you just heard from Mark Ingles?
I honestly think you were a little hard on him. It's too soon to know what really happened. And Hillary, because he's so famous, jumped on the apparent situation with 40 people indifferently marching past a dying climber. But I'm not sure that that's really the right story. If someone turned to David Sharp and said, "Who are you?" and he said, "My name is David Sharp and I'm with Asian Trekking," how are you supposed to know he's near death? There's people exhausted and taking long, long rests all the way up and down Everest.
Let's explain what happened, because the group that Mark Ingles, the double amputee, was with, several members of that group did stop and give him some aid, but they went all the way up, and then they came and passed David Sharp, the man who ultimately died, on the way back as well. They were told, Mark Ingles, as he said, he radioed down to someone at base, and they told him, "No, you know, come on down. Don't try to rescue David Sharp because he's near death." That's what they told him then. But later, a couple of Sherpas went up, and they were the ones who had video cameras in their helmets. And as you just said, David Sharp said to them, "My name is David Sharp, and I am with Asian Trekking." So you're saying, what, it's complicated? It's hard to tell? It's hard to know when to risk your life?
It's hard to tell whether somebody's near death or simply exhausted and doing all right. It's also almost impossible to carry someone down the mountain from that high.
That's climber David Roberts. He's commenting on Mark Ingles, who was the first double amputee to summit Mount Everest, but that fact has been overshadowed by the fact that Mark was one of 40 climbers who walked past another man who eventually died because no one saved him, no one brought him down. David Roberts, in the studio with us, author of On the Ridge Between Life and Death, he knows a thing or two about death on the mountain. He knows what it's like to regret having a climber next to you die. It's happened to him several times. And he said that that's actually why he thinks that, you know, maybe climbers take too many risks and put loved ones at risk. We're going to be back with more with climber David Roberts about the controversy on Everest and the world of mountaineering. Much more ahead, here and now. On the Ridge Between Life and Death. It's a book about his climbing days. And we're talking about the controversy surrounding Mount Everest. A man, David Sharp, was apparently, reportedly, left behind by up to 40 climbers. He reportedly was struggling to live. He didn't have his gloves on. But at another moment, he told other climbers his name. So the question is, should the climbers have tried to save him? And David, you were saying that maybe I was a little too hard on Mark Ingles, who was one of the climbers who passed by David Sharp. Tell me more about that, because, you know, some would say, in fact, there were Sherpas who went up and spoke to the man who was stranded, David Sharp, and some have said you could just put him in a sleeping bag and drag him down. Why do you think it's too hard in asking the question, you know, why didn't you save him?
Well, it's a lot harder than you'd think to just put him in a sleeping bag and drag him down, especially on the north side of Everest, which is much more precipitous than the south side. And as I said before, it's not easy to tell how whether an exhausted climber is near death or whether he's can take care of himself. He seemed to speak lucidly, and it's forgivable that someone might have thought, well, he can take care of himself. At the same time, there is a terrible dehumanizing effect, both of altitude and of people's obsession with Everest. And it's certainly true that there have been many instances in the last few years where people have callously walked past dying climbers, especially on Everest.
Climbers, we understand, use the term hard man to describe an unsentimental mountaineer who can block out tragedy and focus on getting the top and saving himself. Now, I've only been to 19 or 20,000, you know, at Kilimanjaro, and I know I could barely function. so there is that element. But what about some of the things that you've written about, which are that so many people are placing themselves at risk in climbing these mountains? Are too many people trying this? Is it making it more dangerous for everyone?
Well, I think Everest is a special case, and it is a circus, and it's pretty regrettable what's going on there. It's not happening on any other mountain on Earth right now. People have become so obsessed with getting to the highest point on Earth that there are all these gimmicks about trying to set new records. Apparently, a Sherpa took his clothes off on the summit to be the first guy to stand nude on the summit of Everest.
And how cold is it there?
25 below, mm-hmm. something. Mm-hmm. But I think what's going on in Everest is ludicrous and regrettable. But it's not going to stop because every year there are more and more people doing it.
Well, but I wonder, too, if what we were just talking about that was happening on Everest, maybe too many people, maybe a callousness, is also a part of mountain climbing in general. You've spoken about this on this program. We heard a lot of climbers were upset about it when you said, you wrote in your book, "Who might I have helped or comforted had my own needs not come first? I wonder whether I might have been a better husband had I not been such a fanatic climber and a better son to my parents."
Yeah. Hard man is indeed the term still in usage for a good climber who cuts off his feelings for other people. But it's still, even so, I've just co-written Ed Veaster's autobiography about being the first American to climb the 14 highest peaks. Mm. At least five times in his career, Ed gave up the summit to help somebody else down a mountain, an 8,000er. And he didn't think twice about it. And he didn't just give them oxygen and tea. He literally short-roped or dragged or carried them down the mountain at considerable risk to his own life and at the cost of the summit. So a guy like Ed is not... He's a hard man, and yet he's not as callous to the fates of others as a lot of the people we're witnessing on Everest today.
Right. There was video reportedly taken of the dying David Sharp, reportedly both by the Discovery Channel and then the video that we mentioned in the Sherpa cameras. That might eventually get out to the world. What impact do you think that's going to have?
Well, it's going to be awful for his family, I think. Mm. Maybe ultimately cathartic. I don't know. I think, as I said at the top, I think it's too soon to really know what has been going on the last week on Everest. Yeah.
You, in your book, also detail how, before you were 22 years old, you saw, sometimes right next to you, three climbing partners, perhaps good friends, die.
Four, actually.
Four.
Three accidents.
Yeah.
Four climbers.
I remember the words. One slipped away and you just heard the sound of the nylon jacket against mm-hmm. the rock right next to you. Do mountaineers also have to make themselves immune to that possibility of death in order to keep climbing?
Yeah. I became a hard man despite those three fatal accidents by the age of 22 and convinced myself that I wouldn't get killed. And it was only decades later that I looked back and saw how dehumanizing that was for me.
Yeah. Is that part of what happens on a mountain that, you know, I can't really even see if this guy might be dying because, he's automatically in another column from me.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think hypoxia, lack of oxygen, actually does have this dehumanizing effect. It kind of makes a bubble around you. You said you felt it on Kilimanjaro. Mm-hmm. You could barely function.
Right.
It's pretty hard to really be alert to someone else's plight.
Right. What do you think is going to happen, David Roberts, because of the case of David Sharp on Everest? And what's a huge controversy, if people want to learn more, they can go on websites such as everestnews.com. But what do you think is going to happen in the climbing world? Anything?
No. It's going to be more popular than ever. The great irony is that after 96, when John Krakauer wrote Into Thin Air and deplored the whole situation.
John Cracker, by the way, someone who you mentored him.
Yeah, mm-hmm. he was my student. Mm-hmm. But after John deplored the situation on Everest, the applications for guided permits to go up Everest increased by 50% the next year. Mm. People are all too willing to go out there and possibly die. Mm. And I think the same thing will happen next year. The Everest will be more popular than ever, and there'll be more people on it on the mountain that shouldn't be there.
Since you've had your revelations and your self-examination, if you were on the mountain, would you have stopped to save him?
I can't say that. I mean, you'd have to factor in everything that Mark Inglis was mm-hmm. talking about. What kind of shape was he in himself, and how mm-hmm. close to exhaustion? Mm-hmm. I'd like to think I would have, mm-hmm. but I can't be holier than thou about it.
David Roberts, author of On the Ridge Between Life and Death, a book about his climbing days. He has a new book coming out in the fall. He co-authors with Ed Viesters. It's called No Shortcuts to the Top. And David, thanks so much for coming in and weighing in on the current Everest controversy with us.
Thank you.
And this note, Monday on Here and Now, we're going to have a preview of the World Cup soccer match that's coming up in Germany, and we'll learn why English fans are being warned no jokes about World War II and no goose stepping. That's Monday. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
There today that the West will not deprive his country of nuclear technology. This comes as the U.S. and five world powers make plans to offer incentives to Iran to halt its nuclear program, with a backup threat of U.N. Security Council action if Iran turns down the deal. Well, Jordan is one country the U.S. has traditionally turned to help navigate the murky waters of Middle East politics. But Jordan is facing growing pressures as the region becomes increasingly unstable. Unrest throughout the Middle East, from the militant group Hamas taking power to Iran's heightened feud with the West over nuclear technology, has an impact on Jordan. Prince Hassan bin Talal, uncle to the king of Jordan, says his country has always felt the pressures of its neighbors.
I remember speaking to Shimon Peres when he was Prime Minister of Israel, and he used to say, "Oh, I'm surrounded by enemies." And I said to him, "You think you've got a problem? I'm surrounded by friends."
Prince Hassan delivered the commencement address at Brandeis University recently. That's where Here Now's Kevin Sullivan spoke with him about the growing unrest in the Middle East, starting with a dispute over what the West calls Iran's rogue nuclear program.
Well, Iran is a populist leadership today. 44% are living under a dollar a day. 2 million people are drug abusers. And when you're in that situation and you've been under sanctions for a decade and have fought a war in which 1 million people have been lost on both sides, the Iraq-Iran war in the 80s, you get to a position, I think, where you feel you don't have much to lose. I find it tragic that people go on about the fact that the Middle East is an unstable region. And well, we're living in that region, and we don't want it to be unstable. As far as weapons of mass destruction, I'm living in the middle of the danger zone. I want to see that region happy for our children's children.
Right now, there's a crisis looming, really, with Iran and its nuclear ambitions. There have been reports of the U.S. using military force to prevent Iran from moving forward with its nuclear ambitions. Where would Jordan stand if the U.S. did use military force in Iran?
Well, I think Jordan and most of the region's countries would be facing an enormous populist backlash. There are 1.5 billion Muslims, and there might be a coming together of these people in basically as in rabble-rousing at the time of Saddam Hussein's entrance into Kuwait or in his war against Iran, rabble-rousing against the established order of rulers in the region, including Jordan.
Let's move on to talk about Iraq a little bit more. You wrote in Britain's The Daily Telegraph in December that the U.S. has spent its currency of goodwill, that when the U.S. arrived, maybe there were some people who were welcoming them because it meant that Saddam Hussein was leaving. But since then, that currency has been spent. Do you think American troops need to leave immediately, or when do you think they should withdraw?
I think there need to be a timetable and a restatement of intention, certainly, to which we can all work. And I also think that there need to be a backroom retreat where people who comprehend and really know the situation are given a chance at least to rest their conscience.
Now, you reference the fact that once an Iraqi government is formed, that will help bring about stability, and that's what leaders in the U.S. and Iraq have said as well, that we'll start to see this vacuum of power filled once the Iraqi government is formed, and that seems to be happening slowly but surely. But what would prompt the people who now have power, the militias, the militia leaders like Muqtada al-Sadr, to give up the power that they've been able to take hold of?
Well, I think that in both in Afghanistan and Iraq, and I mean, Afghanistan is a country of ravines, and each ravine has a warlord. You don't have ravines in Iraq, but each region has a warlord. But the turning of the lemon into lemonade is to say that these differences are going to be part of a new pluralist Iraq, with an acceptable reconciliation formula, as within South Africa. But unfortunately, people like Mandela are hard to find.
I don't know if you've heard in the news, there's been a lot of controversy about some of the commencement speakers in the Boston area with Condoleezza Rice at Boston College. There was an article written in the Brandeis student newspaper which was very critical of you making the address, and the headline was, "Prince Not Worthy of Addressing Grads." It was written by Joe Farbeen. And I just want to read you one line. It says, "In Jordan, Muslims are forbidden from converting to other faiths. The government appoints imams and forbids them from criticizing the government. Muslim opponents of the regime are frequently detained with baseless accusations of terrorism." Now, if you had an opportunity to speak to this student writer, what would you tell him about Jordan and about these accusations?
Well, I think comprehension leads to understanding, and obviously he's, I assume, working on hearsay. As far as Muslims being forbidden from conversion, I think that the Catholic Church also has a stance on excommunicating people who are speaking outside the context of the Catholic faith. The Ministry of Religious Affairs that he refers to, yes, there are preachers from the Ministry of Religious Affairs, but at the same time there are independent preachers. And I'm sorry that there is discrimination of any kind, but unfortunately this is the case in many countries. But I'm not personally responsible for all the sins of omission and commission in my country. I'd be glad to broaden my shoulders and say, well, you know, throw it all on me. But I feel just as sorry as he does about the fact that we don't live in a perfect world.
What are some of the changes that you would like to see in Jordan? You mentioned one in terms of the democratic reforms you would like to see. What are some of the others?
I would like to see us all living up to fundamental rights of humanity, which is an international proposal sustaining our call for a law of peace. I'd like to see a racial equality index, to which we all abide, which was proposed by the High Commission for Human Rights, on which I served. A free judiciary, a competent judiciary. It means dispelling ignorance. It means promoting legal awareness, legal empowerment. It means building a civil society that does not fear the secret police. And that is, of course, the problem in all our countries. 9/11 has given a huge mandate to hard security. And this is not acceptable. Even the King of Jordan, in a statement recently, has said that he would not allow hard security to be the only tool of government and governance. We have to live up to that.
Right, and in terms of that, Amnesty International has accused Jordan of being one of the sites of the U.S. secret detention facilities. Do you think that's something that would happen in Jordan?
Well, you know very well that many countries have been accused of this, and if Amnesty says so, I'm not on the in the loop of conversation with Amnesty. But at the same time, isn't Guantanamo and Abu Ghraib also part of this whole mess? I mean, I think we all have to sit down and recognize that 9/11 has created a rippling effect, which is really corroding the moral fiber and the judicial integrity of many of our countries.
What do you think is the path forward, then?
If the day of judgment comes, according to the Holy Prophet, and you have a fruit-bearing sapling in your hand, plant it anyway. So I can't afford to be pessimistic when I look at the pictures of my grandchildren. I just have to go the extra mile.
That's Prince Hassan bin Talal, uncle to the King of Jordan. He was speaking recently to Here Now's Kevin Sullivan when the prince was in the Boston area to deliver the commencement at Brandeis University. And speaking of a planting, as the prince just was, this note for you. Monday on Here and Now, we're going to speak to journalist Sandy Tolan. He's traced the conflict in the Middle East through the history of a single lemon tree. It was planted by Palestinians, but later tended by the Jewish family that moved into the Palestinian home. It's a fascinating story, as well as a look at the last 100 years in the area.
Still to come today, teenage musicians take on the very adult music of Mahler. You're listening to Here and Now. A week from this Sunday, Broadway honors its best with the 60th Annual Tony Awards. We thought we'd take a look back at a couple of conversations we've had with the nominees, beginning today with Broadway diva Patti LuPone, a Best Actress nominee for her performance as the villainous yet endearing pie baker Mrs. Lovett in Stephen Sondheim's Sweeney Todd.
The worst pies in London, and no wonder with the price of meat what it is when you get it. Never thought I'd live to see the day. Many think it was a treat finding poor animals what are dying in the street.
Sweeney Todd is up for 6 awards, including Best Revival of a Musical. A Tony for Patti LuPone would be her second. She won back in 1980 for Evita, but as she told us last April, Sweeney Todd holds a special place in her heart.
Oh, I'm the happiest I've ever been on a stage. It's one of those blessed experiences. Our director, John Doyle, assembled a true ensemble where we have each other's backs. The most wonderful thing is that because there's only 10 actors with 10 instruments, there's a minimal amount of sound. So there's no barrier, as we see so much in Broadway theaters now, there's no barrier of sound between the stage and the audience. So it allows the audience to come to the stage as in the old days, which is electric.
And then there's the tuba. Let's remind people, as you were saying, Sweeney Todd has been produced by opera companies. It usually has big orchestration. Your production is receiving a lot of attention because, as you say, it's so small. The actors play all the musical instruments. You play the tuba? Now, I understand you had played the tuba before.
Yes, I played it in the Northport Long Island High School marching band. We had an all-girls sousaphone line. I know. It's so sexy, it's scary.
But wait a minute. Weren't you, Patti LuPone, the star of all the high school musicals as well? Why were you playing the tuba?
In high school, the band leader was a graduate of Northwestern University, and he was able to get the most current marching routines. He and a band leader from Herricks High School decided that they were going to take their high school bands to a band camp. I went when my brothers were in the band, and I thought, this is really sexy. How do I get in on this? Because you'd march all day, and it was dark at night. So I figured, well, I'll get in the band somehow. And then because I was class clown, I went, well, what's the most ridiculous thing I could do? And it was play the sousaphone, and my band leader strapped a sousaphone around my neck, and the rest is history.
Let's remind people of the Sweeney Todd storyline. The title character, which is played by Michael Cerveris, is a barber who escapes from a false imprisonment only to find that he's lost his wife and his child is in the care of the man who had him arrested. So Sweeney ends up taking his vengeance on the world by murdering the customers of his barbering business. You play Mrs. Lovett, who takes the bodies and bakes them into pies, which turns out to be a great business. And there's a wonderful song where you come up with that idea. Let's just hear a little.
Take, for instance, Mrs. Mooney and her pie shop. Business never better, using only pussy cans and toast. Now a pussy's good for maybe 6 or 7 at the most. And I'm sure they can't compare as far as taste.
Mrs. Lovett, what a charming notion.
Well,
eminently practical and yet appropriate
waste.
As always. Mrs. Lovett, how I did without you all these years, I'll never know.
Think
how
about it, lots of other gentlemen will soon be
also
coming for a shave. Won't they think of all them boys?
Oh, what's the sound of...
How would you characterize Mrs. Lovett as you play her?
Well, she's pragmatic. Times are hard. She has to do what she has to do to survive, and she genuinely loves Sweeney, and she will hold on to him at all costs. And it is a dark tale, but I don't think we look at anything. You know, we go through life and hit dark patches, but we don't go, like this. We just sort of find our way through it and move on. And I think that there's optimism in both of these characters through the darkness. Well, maybe not on Sweeney's part, but I think that Mrs. Lovett is just glad she's got a man in her life, and now She's got some money in her pocket.
Yeah, and it's a remarkable thing, really, when you think about, you know, a play that's been such a hit so many times that is about people baking people into pies.
Well, I don't know what to tell you about that. I do know that we have a lot of kids in the audience, and we refer to it as the slasher musical. but the kids love it. The kids don't mind the blood. Maybe it's a horror movie. Maybe it's the equivalent of a horror movie that we love to watch.
Patti LuPone speaking to us recently about what would soon become her Tony-nominated performance in Broadway's Sweeney Todd. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. It's an orchestral work that's been championed as one of the most important and also one of the most tragic of the 20th century canon. Gustav Mahler's Symphony No. 6 was written during one of the happiest times of his life, but unlike its predecessors, which resolve in triumph or tranquility, Mahler's 6th feels relentlessly grim. Conductor Benjamin Zander is no stranger to the work. He conducted the Philharmonia Orchestra of London for a famous recording of Mahler's Symphony No. 6, and Zander is now conductor of the Youth Philharmonic Orchestra at the New England Conservatory, and he's bringing this famously dark work to kids. And conductor Benjamin Zander joins us in the studio to explain why. Welcome.
Thank you.
And I know you've also brought along someone who's going to help with that explanation. Anna Lewis is a student who, at 16 years old, is a violinist for the Youth Philharmonic, and she's tackling Mahler's 6th. Welcome to you as well, Anna.
Hello, thank you.
So the adjectives to describe this symphony, Benjamin, a maze of nightmarish visions, unremittingly bleak. Why did you choose this piece for kids?
It actually isn't unremittingly bleak. It has some of the most positive, affirmative, life-giving music that Mahler ever wrote. What it does is it ends tragically. The hero, at the moment of greatest glory, just towards the end, is suddenly cut down by a terrible blow. But the piece veers between very dark and grim and tragic music to some of the most affirmative and life-giving and extraordinarily exuberant music that he ever wrote and that has ever been written. So these young people respond to the whole range of human emotion.
In fact, there's one place in the music in particular. You call it the 59?
There's a passage which we all love so much because the whole orchestra plays full out with all its passion and intensity, and we call it 59 because that's the number, that is the rehearsal number. And whenever I mention that passage, everybody lights up. But we play it beautifully, and the kids dig in with all their heart.
Let's listen. His face is just grinning. What are you feeling when you play this majestic passage?
When we play this piece, especially this movement, the violins together and the whole orchestra has to channel emotions to each other that I think, especially as young people, we're learning to deal with different emotions, and we learn to feel them at different moments together with Mr. Zander.
My memory, do you mind if I call you Benjamin?
Please.
Mr. Zander. You know, my memory of, you know, working with classical music when I was young is that sometimes you felt like your heart would burst. I mean, yeah.
That is exactly how it is with so many parts in this piece. It's just, you start to shake sometimes because you just feel so deeply touched inside.
There's a passage in the first movement, the second theme, which describes his wife. He came down from the hut where he was composing, and he said, "Alma, I have composed you into my piece." And this is the passage. And the other day we were rehearsing it, and they played it beautifully. And then I told them that story, and then I said, "Imagine what it would be like if somebody composed such music to describe you." And then they played as if a bomb had been exploded on them. I've never heard anything as exciting in my entire life as these 40 violins playing their heart out. And teenagers have access to emotions that sometimes older people don't have.
Let's listen to that passage. Are playing in that passage.
Yes, I am.
Not in that recording, but in the concert with the youth orchestra. What is that like for you?
I think it's like
OMG.
OMG. That's definitely an OMG moment.
OMG. I'm guessing. Oh my God.
Yeah. Yes. A couple of us taught Mr. Zander that last year.
Yeah, right. Everything was OMG. OMG.
I feel completely honored and special to play that music, and especially at that moment, because it's such a deep feeling that Mahler had for his wife and that he was trying to express, and you feel special playing it, and you feel like you have a purpose, and I just wish everyone could feel like that in their life.
One of the students in the orchestra wrote a note and said, "I come from Montana. I wish that my family and my friends in Montana could hear this, but we live in the country and we don't ever hear things like this." Mm. And I think one forgets what a privilege it is for them and for us to be in a community in which we can hear this music and participate in it, and even young people in high school can play it. It's just unbelievable. Mahler never would have imagined in his wildest dreams, I think, that this music could be available.
What's the takeaway, though? You know, it's referred to as the tragedy.
I think all the symphonies of Mahler make a whole, so you have to think of the whole work, and this is a tragic look. But I think one comes out of it, even out of the tragic moments, feeling it uplifted through the catharsis. That's what tragedy does for us. It teaches us that however great the suffering, we all always have the strength to create art and to go beyond it.
Anna, you're 16?
I'm actually 17.
Oh, well, see, that changes everything. 17. Do you want to be a professional?
I definitely want to be a professional musician or tie in what I've learned from Mr. Zander and all the stories that he's told us about how to live life to the fullest, and tie that into whatever I do in my life. And I think that you can just make whatever you're doing the most exciting thing and make it just everyone around you just be amazed at how much energy you have for whatever you're doing.
Anna Lewis is a violinist in the Youth Philharmonic Orchestra at the New England Conservatory here in the Boston area. Benjamin Zander is conductor of the orchestra. And by the way, if you're in the area, they'll be performing Symphony No. 6 in A Minor by Gustav Mahler this weekend. For more on that, see our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again, Here and Now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.